As an unlicensed doctor, we suggest a prescription for one of our shows. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Fake Doctor's Orders. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Hey, happy Saturday to you. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Jordan Heath Rawlings and Jeff Simmons. Lots going on this weekend. We will get to those Mike Babcock extension rumors. Are they real? Are they phony? Is it all fiction, like Mr. Babcock says? Also, the Oilers don't have that 11-game losing streak anymore. They got a little smaller one. It's three-gamer now. They've lost 14 of 15. And, man, it's tough to look at Dallas Eakins after these games. Victor Foss losing his mind yesterday. Also, Blue Jays don't do much at the winter meetings. They've overhauled that team pretty significantly this offseason, but still lots of work to do. And, oh, yes, lots of NFL talk as well coming your way in the next couple of hours. But we start with the Toronto Maple Leafs, who host the Red Wings, tail end of a home-and-home with Detroit. They beat them the other day despite being outshot by 10 trillion. On Wednesday, shots were 42-19, and the Corsi was like 70-30. It was ridiculous. The tail end of that game, they end up getting the goal to tie it up in the third period and winning it in a shootout. And you got to give them credit, okay? Ever since losing those two games by a combined score of 15-4 to the Sabres and Predators, Maple Leafs have won 7 of 9. And points in 8 of 9. So, Jordan, what do we make of this team right now? Are they the team that's giving up a ton of shots like they've done 2 out of the last 3 games? Or are they the consistent team that's won 7 of 9?
They are who we thought they were.
I guess, right? They're in one of those wild card spots.
They're a team that's going to be kind of life or death to make the playoffs going down the stretch. They're going to have great runs because they can really get it up and get skating and the puck goes in the net and they get great goaltending. They're going to have embarrassing losses because they get outshot by a lot. And sometimes when you get outshot by a lot, all the pucks end up in your net. So one of those things where I want to see them over the long stretch of the year. I don't want to get too high. I don't want to get too low, which makes me the opposite of this Leafs team.
Yeah, this team has some pretty high highs and low lows. But Jeff, you look at the overall, the Corsi numbers don't look good, don't look very good, and the shots on goal and all that. But regulation overtime wins, right? The shootout win they had over the Red Wings, that was their first all season. So this team is not built up on the skills competition, and their regulation overtime wins put them right up there among the leaders in the Eastern Conference.
Yeah, they're definitely an improved team this year. They're a lot deeper. They got 4 capable lines this year. They had some good free agent pickups. Winnick's been pretty good. Santarelli's been a really solid player on the 1-year deal. But they're still not a team you can believe in, as they're still flawed in some sense. They still rely way too much on their goalie. We mentioned how many shots they're giving up. And you'd like to see them play a little more balanced game. They still don't drive possession enough. And we know how serious people take that. And with them, there's some things to believe in. Their offense is pretty good, and they can score goals, but you got to see them be more consistent. They're on a good run right now, but a lot of these games are at home. The World Juniors are coming up, and they're going to have to go on the road for a while, so it's going to be tough for them as a stretch, so this might be their better stretch of the year.
We're going to see. I mean, this is pretty much exactly the same conversation we could have had about them at this point last year, right? They're on a little roll. They're looking pretty good. Things are clicking for them. They're getting great goaltending. So what if they're getting badly outshot some nights? You know, this is a team that can beat anybody on any given night, and that's okay, and that might get them into the playoffs. But here's the thing. In the playoffs, you have to do more than beat one team on any given night. You have to beat the same team on 4 given nights. And I don't trust this Leafs team with their inconsistency and their head coach to be able to take out a better team 4 times out of 7.
Well, you made the comparison that is apt, I think, because whatever you wanted to say in revisionist history about that team last year, that was, you know, really battling for one of those top 2 spots in the Eastern Conference when they went out west to California, won 2 out of those 3 games on that West Coast road trip before Jonathan Bernier went down. People looked at the underlying numbers and said this isn't sustainable. Turns out it wasn't. Now, I don't know if it's quite as bad this year as
the
far
underlying
as,
numbers aren't as bad, but
they're not
good.
Great. No. Is it fair to say that this is history repeating itself, that we're looking at a carbon copy of the 2013-2014 season with this Toronto Maple Leafs team?
Well, like Jeff said, I mean, they're a better team.
Having
four lines makes a huge difference. You essentially had two forwards last year that you played for 5 minutes a game, if that, and you sort of had to spread the rest of the ice time around, and that made them weak at the end of games. It made guys tired.
Yeah, Kessel and JVR last year at the end of the year, they completely ran out of gas.
Right, and you had an Olympic year as well.
Yeah.
Played into it.
They were so reliant on that first line to score, and when they went dry at the end of the season, they had no scoring, and the team was just a disaster. And having four lines does help, but as you said, the underlying numbers are still the big question, and the defense is still sketchy at best. So it's hard to imagine them turning this around without improved play on the back end.
It's hard to trust that defense core against a really good bunch of forwards in a playoff series.
Now, it's not every game they're giving up 40-some-odd shots. I know it's two out of the last three has been this exact same formula where the goaltender gets shelled, and maybe you can point to the Canucks game as being kind of a score effects, maybe. I don't know if you're really grasping at straws, but yeah, they gave up 46 shots against to Vancouver and end up winning 5-2. They give up 42 against the Red Wings at Joe Louis on Wednesday, only have 19, end up winning 2-1 in a shootout. But, you know, they outplayed the Flames in the middle period of that game. It's not obvious to say that, oh, they were outplayed and outworked and they just got great goaltending to win that one 4-1. They beat the Flames 4-1, a team that I guess now is, you want to talk about underlying numbers, maybe that's starting to come back to haunt Calgary. They maybe got a lousy loss against the Devils. I don't think they were outplayed heavily. The Stars game was just a horrible game defensively from both teams. But this isn't the point is, it's not every night that this is the formula with this team. They do outplay teams occasionally and win too, right? It's not just we get shelled and win because we're a good line rush team.
No, but this is what I mean when I say that they are who we thought they were, right? Like, if you look at the games where they do get outshot, they tend to be against good possession teams. Like, I don't think anybody would say that Vancouver and Detroit are teams that don't dominate the puck and that they're built to do that. And yeah, they can outskate and outshoot teams like Calgary because, you know, Calgary is a bad possession team, worse than the Leafs. So it's tough to look at this team at this point in the season and take it as anything more than a snapshot, I guess, is all I'm saying. You got to look at them.
But we're looking at 28 games here. It's not a snapshot, right?
Well, talking about a snapshot right now. Like, if you looked at this team 2 weeks ago, you'd be like, oh, that looked terrible.
Because just the memory of those two losses. But you take those two horrible, horrible losses out of it, they've actually been terribly consistent all season long. They've been pretty consistent bunch. They haven't had long stretches of losing streaks. They've lost three straight once, and that was over that stretch where they lost to Buffalo and Nashville. Before that, it was a 2-1 loss to the Penguins, which they played actually half decent in that game as well. It's been a consistent bunch all season long, Jeff. We're not looking at this being, I know it's a good stretch recently as far as putting up wins, but they really haven't been horrible and now are getting great. It's been fairly consistent all season.
And that's what makes it so hard to judge them almost, because they have extreme highs and lows. And whenever they go either way, people seem to overreact to either side. And as consistent as they can be in stretches, it's just, you almost expect the worst with this team, as sad as it's to say. And when they outshoot people
are... And that's because you've lived in the city too long, Jeff.
It's because they've given you the worst.
Right.
When they outshoot people are like celebrating and joking about it because it's so rare. And that's kind of the way the team's looked at these days, and they're still a fringe playoff team, and they
play in the Eastern Conference, which helps. Like, ask the Edmonton Oilers where they think they would be if they played in the Eastern Conference, because let's not forget, like, they had a pretty good stretch there when they were playing Eastern Conference opponents. Still only have one win against the West this season, which is a problem when you play in the Western Conference, but still, the Eastern Conference is far, far inferior to the Western Conference. Would you still be shocked? Wouldn't you put the Leafs in a playoff series against any other team in the Eastern Conference? Are they going to get their clocks cleaned in the playoffs?
They get their clocks cleaned by the Penguins. I think they get their clocks cleaned probably by the Lightning, probably by the Red Wings.
They beat the Lightning, look, maybe in their best game of the year, coming off those two losses to Nashville and Buffalo. played pretty well against the Lightning. Yeah, they haven't beat the Penguins. They played some good games, came back with a couple of Tyler Bozak goals to send it to overtime before losing. Really, would you be shocked like if they took the Penguins or the Lightning to seven games or beat them?
See, I wouldn't.
Yeah, me neither.
I didn't think they had a chance against Boston 2 years ago.
Right.
And everyone would have thought they would have won one game better. They outplayed them.
Who had the Rangers and the Habs in the Eastern Conference Final last year?
Yeah, the playoffs are a finicky thing. And when you get goaltending like the Leafs do, and when you can score in bunches, I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't expect it or anything. But with the way the Leafs play, that kind of suits for they can get, if they're hot in the right time, they could definitely be one of
those
teams. Sure,
but that's not an argument that's specific to the Leafs.
Right.
This is the thing about the playoffs is that it is a small sample, and hockey especially, where the puck is out of your control for so long, it can take a bounce, it can deflect off somebody and go in the net. That can happen to anybody. So you can't sit here and be like, well, I wouldn't be surprised to see the Leafs beat anybody. I wouldn't be surprised to see anybody beat anybody in the Stanley Cup playoffs. It just kind of happens. So what you have to look at is you have to look at what's beyond the luck. And I'm not saying that any of these advanced stats are the be-all and end-all. I'm just saying that they're sort of what we have to go on when you're talking about a game in which any team can win 4 out of 7 games.
Yeah. And you touched on it, the goaltending. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Ennis, alongside Jordan Heath-Rawlings and Jeff Simmons. The goaltending has been good. It really wasn't outstanding early in the season, but recently, Jonathan Bernier, with his long stretch of games started, was good. And then on Wednesday, back end of back-to-back games, James Reimer gets his first start in about 3 weeks and is redonkulous. Now, a lot of people were surprised to see Reimer back in Toronto. It's a deal that made sense, and I guess he just couldn't find a number one gig somewhere else. I think if he walked into that Edmonton Oilers dressing room tomorrow, he's probably the starter there. But it's a pretty big luxury when you've got a couple of guys who you can throw in there and can steal a game for you, because that's exactly what happened in Detroit on Wednesday. That game was stolen. His second stolen 2 points of the season, stole two against the Chicago Blackhawks, giving up like 20 shots in the third period. He stole that game against the Red Wings. And there's not many teams out there who have as capable a backup as the Maple Leafs do with James Reimer.
No, it really says a lot about Reimer that after 3 weeks, he can come off the bench and not play and put out that kind of game to steal a game for the Leafs, and a game they are terribly outshot. And it's true, there aren't a lot of teams right now, especially fringe playoff teams, with two really capable goaltenders. And James Reimer, I think, is a really capable backup. I don't know if he's a great starter.
He proved that at the tail end of last season.
Yeah, I think it was pretty telling that someone like Brian Burke didn't go out and get him when he had a goalie opening. That was
sure.
That was his guy, and Winnipeg kept their own guys rather than getting the local boy. And I think the Leafs were lucky to get him back, and well, fortunate, I guess, and it's a really good situation to have right now.
Says a lot about him as a character guy, too. I know sometimes we overrate character, but the fact that, like, it went so awful at the end of last year, you know, he was blamed for so much of that. His wife was attacked on Twitter. He kind of asked for a trade. You know, all these things kind of happened, and he ended up re-signing, and he went back to work and handled his business and was there. He's ready to play when they want him to play, which is, you know, you don't want to overrate it, but at the same time, like, it makes a difference in a dressing room when you have a guy who's just professional and easygoing and handles what's happening.
One of the other maybe buoying reasons why the Maple Leafs have as many regulation overtime wins as they do is they also have 11 home wins because they played a whole lot of home games.
What's their road record?
Their road record is 5-2-3, where they are 11-7-0. At home, so pretty good on the road as well, but they played a lot of home games, and you know what that means, a bunch of road games coming up, naturally, with the World Juniors at Air Canada Center. They're going to be on the road, and they're going to be on the road against some pretty good teams, especially over the Christmas break. They go to Chicago. Dallas stinks. I think we all understand that. Florida, Tampa Bay, Boston, Minnesota, Winnipeg, and then come back home for two, and then go back on the murderous Western road trip of L.A., Anaheim, San Jose, and St. Louis. Ooh. So that being said, you know, if they go on a tough stretch here, everyone's going to say, well, we saw it coming. It is history repeating itself. The underlying numbers suggested that this might happen, but it also might be a byproduct of the schedule, right? Like, what is the true reason the Maple Leafs might slump going forward? Is it because of their style of players? The fact that, you know, they've been built up by a bunch of Eastern Conference home opponents, and eventually that runs out. So, I mean, good on them that they're building this little buffer zone on the ninth spot in the Eastern Conference, but you better keep it up because, you know, tougher times are on the horizon.
They might have better crowds on the road than they do at home. At least people cheer on the road games.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You, you can hear some Go Leafs go on the road sometimes.
Yeah, if there's a Toronto game in Florida in December break, there's a ton of Leaf fans of that game.
Yeah, Jordan, you mentioned Brandon Carlisle. He's the subject of conversation that, you know, you can go both ways on it. And last year, I think I had lots of qualms with him, and I think a lot of people did, especially in the dealing with that fourth line and the way you managed it and the way, you know, it was really a liability to have them on the ice with the tomato cans that they employed. Tomato cans are back on the shelf, okay? They're not even playing with the Marlies. That fourth line is, I don't know, among the better ones in the National Hockey League, depending on who's on it on a night-to-night basis. They can score. I mean, the Leafs can get offense from all four of these lines. But you still aren't sold on Randy Carlisle.
I don't believe.
Why?
He's never given me a reason to believe with the Maple Leafs. You want to think, this is another, I'm going to keep going on about the small sample size. It looks great the last like 7 of 9 games. You know, his moves are working. The fourth line is clicking. They're getting balanced scoring. Even when Phil Kessel looks like he's laboring under an injury, you know, they're getting goal scoring from other places. I refuse to believe that any of this is coming from the coach, because if it was, we would have seen it last year. It's not like Randy Carlisle became a new coach in the offseason. He didn't sit down with Kyle Dubas and have the numbers explained to him.
Well,
Do you think he did?
Maybe he did, firstly. And secondly,
I hope he did.
Part of a change in philosophy, I think, was forced upon him, where his two assistants were ripped from under him and he was forced to take on two assistants that I think at least are trying to change the culture. And you look at that fourth line. I don't know. Is this a fourth line he throws out there last year? I'm not sure.
Probably not, but that's great. You know what I really trust is a guy coaching under duress. Yeah. That really fills me with good confidence.
Yeah, and you don't think Randy Carlisle's been following these Mike Babcock rules? Yeah,
he's looking across the bench tonight being like, ah, you jerk. Don't come for my job.
Yeah, well, so far so good for Randy Carlisle and this Maple Leafs team. But on that, you know, same thought, Kyle Dubas was on this radio station, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, this past week, and Randy Carlisle said it after games. I don't know if he said it as much against the after that Red Wings game on Wednesday, because that was back end of back-to-back. So you could almost forgive that one. Tough game for the Maple Leafs to play. But they've come out and said it, and I don't know if they were as adamant about it last season when they were playing well but getting outshot by 1,000,000 to 1. They're at least understanding the point that if you play 82 games where you're giving up shots at a 2-to-1 rate, it's not a recipe for success. You can't win that way. And it seems obvious now, but honestly, Jeff, it's not something they were saying all that much at the beginning of last season.
No, it's nice to see them acknowledge this for the first time, because last year they kept denying the analytics and they kept saying that we don't believe in this stuff and it's all a bunch of nonsense. I think Dave Notis came out. He's completely flipped his view on that this year, saying that we've been looking at this for years. And there's another point on that. It's kind of strange that teams seem to have to apologize for a good goaltending performance.
Right.
The goalie's not part of the team.
Yeah. And that's exactly the type of game you want your goalie to save you in. I mentioned it's not an easy situation playing the back end of back-to-backs. You look at the overall records for teams in the National Hockey League playing on that back game of back-to-back, especially if it's the same goalie going in both. It's a horrible record. But the fact that the Maple Leafs have two pretty good starters that they can throw one in there, that's exactly what you're looking for your goalie to do.
It's a really good point that Jeff makes. I love analytics. I love talking about them. I love looking at the underlying numbers. I think they tell us a lot of stuff. But it is true that one of the things they can do sometimes is undercut a great goalie's performance. And you look at the best teams, the ones that win the cups, the ones that go deep into the playoffs. It's not a lie, that old sort of adage that you need your goalie to steal some games for you along the way. And, you know, Bernier seems to be able to do that. Reimer certainly stole one for him the other night.
J.S. Giguere got the Ducks deep into a cup final.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's no shortage of teams that you can point to the goalie being the main reason they won a cup. And we do end up apologizing. It's weird because, you know, if you look at a football team and their defense plays horrible and their running back can't get anything going, but Peyton Manning throws for four touchdowns to one receiver and that wins the game, you don't go in there and apologize. You know, you don't go in there and be like, well, you know, it's too bad that Peyton Manning had to throw for four touchdowns and win us the game there.
I get the comparison. I don't know if it's 100% apt because
it's the closest thing I got.
I mean, because the offense isn't, as much as we say it's just Peyton Manning, it's more than just Peyton Manning. Whereas a goaltending, you know, that is actually just James Reimer. It's all on James Reimer.
Two hardest jobs in sports, though. That's where the comparison comes
from. Maybe a pitcher.
Yeah, a pitcher, absolutely.
Pitchers do get tons of credit for stealing games.
That's the difference. If a pitcher comes out, throws a no-hitter, and the team strikes out and gets one run,
you don't
hear the same kind of thing.
No. It was funny to hear James Reimer after that game, though, kind of give his defense some credit, saying that, I faced a lot of shots, but they were kind of, you know, the outside wasn't exactly what I saw in that game. But
James Reimer knows what he's got to say now. He's learned.
I guess.
You know what? I was impressed with Carlisle's comments after the game, though.
Me too.
That he showed some humor.
What a funny guy, eh?
Well, considering the situation he's in, he's been taking a lot of stuff from the media this year. And after that Nashville loss, people were calling for his firing. And
sure.
The fact that he still has a sense of humor about it, I think that says a lot about him. I think we can criticize him a lot as a coach, but that was kind of nice to see.
We'll see how much of a sense of humor he has if the Maple Leafs go on an extended period of losses. But so far, so good. Having won 7 of their last 9 points and 8 of 9, got the Detroit Red Wings in town tonight, which means more questions about Mike Babcock, especially considering the news that's kind of floated around recently. There was a report that an extension was just about done. Babcock said that is fantasy. And where does the truth lie? Maybe somewhere in the middle. Maybe not. We'll discuss that and whether the fantasy of Mike Babcock in Toronto is still alive. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Annis alongside Jeff Simmons and Jordan Heath Rawlings on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet Magazine, here's Christina Rutherford.
The interview. It's in every issue, a one-on-one with a sports star. We asked Arnold Palmer about the perfect mixture for his drink, but Mr. Palmer wouldn't give up the secret. Boston Bruins D-man Zdeno Chara says he's tired of talking about how tall he is. Everyone knows.
It's kind of like every article starts that way, like, okay, Zdeno Chara, 6'9", towering, big, strong. It always starts that way. I'm like, oh my God, like, does every player gets their stat of measurement, of weight, height, before they write something about him?
MMA star Ronda Rousey says dislocating someone's elbow kind of feels like tearing a turkey apart. Gross. Alex Ovechkin says he lives in a tiny house in Washington. He lies. And Patrick Kane says if he scores, he's watching the highlight.
That's funny. If I score on the road and I come home, that's probably the first thing I'm doing is pulling up the laptop and watching. I can't watch in front of the teammates or else I'll get made fun of, but that's the first thing I do when I get home, and I'll watch it a few times for sure.
Anyone that
says they don't is lying to you.
That's the interview, folks. Look for it in every issue. And there's an extended version on the iPad.
This story and more appears in the latest edition of Sportsnet Magazine. Available on Next Issue and in the Apple Newsstand. Is it wrong that we want you all to ourselves? Sharing the love for the Leafs. Right here, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Sportsnet
590,
The Fan.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I am Ben Ennis alongside Jeff Simmons and Jordan Heath Rawlings. Maple Leafs back in action tonight, hockey night in Canada. Getting another shot of the winged wheel after that undeserved win. I think it's safe to say it was not deserved, the Maple Leafs. Although, according to Jeff, we still need to give credit to the goalies when they put up a solid performance, which James Reimer did more than hold up his side of the bargain on Wednesday. Maple Leafs escape with a 2-1 shootout win. They're back at it tonight down at the Air Canada Center, which means another dose of Mike Babcock. He is still the head coach of the Detroit Red Wings for now, and it seemed like the drama was close to being over when there was a report earlier this week that the extension with the would-be free agent head coach was pretty much agreed upon. It was going to happen. Since then, Mike Babcock says that's fantasy, and there has not been a retort from the Detroit Red Wings. Hasn't happened. I think it's telling that it hadn't happened yet, and still, I guess, the possibility exists that he could end up as the head coach of the Toronto Maple Leafs this offseason. Where do we truly believe the truth lies? Jordan, do you buy that he is still biding his time until he lands in Toronto, or is this just a matter of time before he stays in Detroit on a longer-term deal?
I think until he signs, there's always a chance, but I really don't see it. And I mean, it's funny because these reports sort of come out there and they pop up and we all talk about them, and then Babcock has to come out and shut them down. But the way the Red Wings conduct their business and have for, 25 years now is they keep it quiet. They keep it in-house. Babcock and Ken Holland have a good relationship. There's a good ownership structure. It's stable. There's no media circus. They just handle their business. And Babcock is very much that way. And especially, I think, at the end of last year when the Red Wings were life and death to miss the playoffs and Datsyuk looked really old and Zetterberg had a bad
back
problem. They couldn't stay healthy. And, you would have had those kind of questions. But it's funny because over the last 12 months or so, you've really seen the Red Wings do what they always do. There's a really good young cast of kids there now who look like many of them are going to turn into real players. And for a guy like Mike Babcock, who has said repeatedly over and over again what he cares about more than anything else is winning. And when he sits down to look at where the future of these clubs are going,
we all care about winning, okay? And sure, winning comes into it if all things are equal. But when you're talking about maybe there being, and I guess this is all speculation and nobody knows the true numbers that would be proposed by the Maple Leafs, but there's no salary cap for paying your head coaches, right? The Maple Leafs are saving a ton now that there is a cap on salaries, player salaries. So there is a number floated out there at about $5 million to bring Mike Babcock into Toronto, which would, almost double the next highest paid head coach in the National Hockey League. And there's talk that this extension with the Red Wings should be worth a little more than $2 million. Sure, winning's great, Jeff, but give me $2.5 million extra per season. And it's not like you're eliminated from winning here in Toronto. And everybody wants to have that, or everybody wants to be that guy that comes into Toronto, whether it's Brian Burke, whether it's Randy Carlyle, whether it's Mike Babcock, that is on the front of that float going down Yonge Street in the middle of the summer.
Yeah, you just nailed it on the head. With this kind of thing, you always got to look at two things, money and ego. And with coaches, someone like Mike Babcock, that would have to appeal to him. Because what Jordan said makes a ton of sense. All logic would point back to Detroit. They've got a much more appealing roster. They got a much more stable management group. You don't have to deal with the board of directors at all.
Yeah.
Detroit's just, there's a lot more, the organization's probably better. They're way more successful. But when it comes to money and ego, that's the kind of thing that can drive someone away. And as he remains unsigned, you have to keep wondering why.
I think you're fooling yourself if you think Mike Babcock is different than anybody else and that money would not sway him. If he sees the allure of not just being the highest paid head coach in the National Hockey League, but being the highest paid coach by a country mile, got to be appealing to the guy, right?
Well, it's a fair point. I mean, I think that Babcock is a guy that he absolutely cares about winning more than anything. But at the same time, more than even the $5 million for himself, there's coaches stick together, and that raises the bar, right? When you set a new level of pay for the highest guy that's a couple million dollars higher, all of a sudden that means, Babcock's good friend Joel Quenneville, when his next contract is up, can say, okay, I want $4.5 million now,
sure,
instead of the 2.5 that I've been making. And guys do feel a responsibility to them, to their profession, to raise the bar like that. But A, I'm not sure. I mean, like you say, these numbers are all speculation. B, the Red Wings are still, by all reports, offering to make him the highest paid coach in hockey. And C, he also has said, in his own words many times before now, that the grass is not always greener on the other side of the fence, that I really appreciate what I have here, that I'm not going to find a relationship like I have with Kenny Holland anywhere else. And he's also got a really good relationship with Jeff Blashill, who coaches the Grand Rapids Griffins and has been bringing up all these prospects. So I'm not doubting what both of you guys say. The money is definitely a consideration. I'm sure it will be. I'm sure he wants to be the highest paid coach in hockey. But at the same time, I mean, his own words have said that, you know, this is the situation that he thinks is best for him right now.
And that's why I brought up ego, because he's done almost anything, everything you can do in a career.
He has
won Stanley Cups. He's won gold medals. At some point, you wonder if maybe ego comes ahead here and saying, can I do this with this Leafs team?
Right, exactly. Being the guy going down Yonge Street, being the guy that ends the drought here in Toronto.
Exactly, because that would be worth more than almost anything in his career, considering the disaster that's been this team for the last couple decades.
But Mike Babcock's also a smart guy, and do you think he looks at this roster in this situation and thinks, I'm going to come in here and be the guy to lead this team down Yonge Street? Or do you think he looks at the Red Wings roster and says, I'm going to make the playoffs for the 24th straight year and have a chance to win the fifth cup in this generation?
Maybe he knows how to draft those Swedes in the fifth round that end up, you know, scoring 30 goals a season. Maybe
he's
got to
bring Hack and Anderson with him, too. I mean, maybe if he can bring Holland and Anderson and all these guys, then yeah, maybe we can turn the Leafs into something.
So it's going to continue being a story as long as he remains unsigned past this season. So that means Randy Carlyle's still got the rearview mirror in full effect, looking over his shoulder. It's got to be a tough way to live life.
I will say this. I would love Mike Babcock to come to Toronto to see Mike Babcock dealing with the media that Randy Carlyle deals with, because that would be just a sideshow and a half, and it would be so much fun because he loves to handle those guys by just shutting them down.
I think Babcock was here during that salute gate, right at the heart of it.
Yeah.
I wonder what if that made him second guess anything, just dealing with the craziness of the...
I think you got to know coming into this situation, and I hear what you're saying about, you know, guys dealing with the media and it might be fun. Ron Wilson, I guess, was kind of fun, but at a certain point it wears on everybody. And you, I don't know if a guy like John Tortorella could exist in Toronto. Talk about fun. That would be fun, but
it'd be great for us doing radio shows on Saturday morning to have these guys here.
No question. But, look at, where the Canucks are now, without, Mr. Tortorella, but back to Randy Carlyle, right? Because it seemed fait accompli, especially after the way things finished last year for the Toronto Maple Leafs and the fact that expectations were, you know, about where they are in the standings right now. They're one of those wild card teams, 7th, 8th spot, and probably a first round exit. What does he have to do, though, Randy Carlyle, to save his job and to erase all doubt? And no matter whether Mike Babcock's available or not, it's not an issue this offseason. What does Randy Carlyle have to do? Where does he have to get this Maple Leafs team, Jeff?
I think they have to at least win a playoff round. Because if they get in and they have a tough series, it won't be much different than the Boston series 2 years ago. And they still were looking to replace him last summer for all indications. So I think he has to win a round and win a round comfortably. Outside of that, if Babcock's available and he wants to come here, I don't think it matters.
Yeah, so even if he... So say they get the Red Wings in the opening round, and they get to a 6th, 7th game. It doesn't matter. If they lose that game, if they're competitive in all 6 or 7 games, it doesn't matter. He's gone.
I think if a coach that they want comes on the market, yeah, I think that's the case.
What if Babcock's not available? I mean, Dan Bylsma is still out there. Is this the head coach Maple Leafs want going forward to lead this team to the next phase of their development? Are they happy with Randy Carlyle? Seems like they've cut a bit of his powers out, right? Mentioned the assistants being forced upon him. Mm-hmm. Is Randy Carlyle the guy that Brendan Shanahan wants, or is he still in the evaluation phase there?
Oh, he's definitely still in the evaluation phase. I mean, I think it's certainly foolish to say that Shanahan would come in and not look at, you know, all the facets of the organization. He hasn't made, we made the assistant coach changes. We made the assistant GM hiring. Those were there, but usually you don't see a new president come into an organization and, especially an organization that hasn't had success, and keep the GM and keep the head coach. I'm sure he's looking at options in both those places, and probably what happens the rest of the year will play out. I do think that if the Leafs can get to the sixth, say they get to a 6th or 7th game against Detroit, it almost for me depends on how they got there. If they play with consistency down the stretch, if they're, you know, even or out shooting teams down the stretch, and they develop into a team that has a solid identity, works hard every night, and can actually carry the play, I think maybe Shanahan would consider it. But if they're this sort of schizophrenic team that we've seen that can beat any team but can also lose really badly, then I think that's on Carlyle and he's probably gone.
It's been an incredibly consistent run for the Maple Leafs recently. 7 of 9 wins headed into tonight's game against the Detroit Red Wings. Elsewhere in the National Hockey League, the Mumps are back. Remember the Mumps? They're back. Corey Perry and the Anaheim Ducks kicked this thing off, running through, I think now the sixth clubhouse could be the Pittsburgh Penguins. Is everybody, I think, has seen the shot of Sidney Crosby now looking like Quagmire, side of his head all blown up. And none of us are doctors, although we'd like to play one on the radio. It looks mumpish. If not the mumps, it looks mump-like. And he's going to miss 2 games as part of the evaluation process. I know someone that had the mumps, so it was not like when I first heard Corey Perry getting it, it wasn't something completely unheard of to me, but it's kind of weird that it hasn't died out. You would think, you know, everybody would have their locker rooms completely sanitized and you wouldn't hear about this again, but I guess the mumps were a tough thing. I don't know. Do you know anything about the mumps, Jordan?
I don't know anything about the mumps, and I accept that I don't want to go near an NHL dressing room these days.
Yeah, seriously. But a lot of people in there with their microphones to Sidney Crosby. I don't know if I'd be as reticent to get in there.
Yeah, it's a strange thing because it's not a really widespread disease.
No.
Not even disease, sickness. And when you see Sidney Crosby's face double in size in that photo.
Right.
You have to wonder what's going on.
The best part is that we don't know if he has the mumps. We think he might not have the mumps. And you're looking at the picture, but well, looks pretty mumpy. And if it's not the mumps, I hope you're still getting it checked out because it looks like something's going on there. I'm no doctor, but something's going on with his face.
I mentioned that I have a buddy who has the mumps, and my buddy that I know that had the mumps just texted me. Mumps are no joke. All right, so he had the mumps. He recovered, made a full recovery. And he is mump-free since 93 right now. Also, over in the Western Conference, the Oilers are at it again, losing hockey games. They fall again to the Anaheim Ducks yesterday, who are the best team in the National Hockey League right now. And they're on a nice little streak as well. 6 straight, not as good as the Blackhawks. 8-game winning streak, but they're quite good. Jumped out to a 3-0 lead, held on 3-2. Victor Faust was yanked in this one after allowing 2 goals in the opening minute of the second period. And if you haven't seen it yet, go check it out. He went ballistic on the bench, threw his helmet down, started yelling at his teammates on the bench. He was at fault. I mean, they were savable shots, but his team was also horrible. And they're a horrible team. They snapped that 11-game losing streak. They've lost 3 straight since then, so 14 of 15 in the loss column. Dallas Eakins looks like a broken man. I don't know. Is there you run out of things to say, I guess, about the Edmonton Oilers, but at a certain point you start to feel bad for Dallas Eakins.
Yeah, that was like last year was the certain
right
point.
And it continues, right? And you thought there was a little respite there with the ending of the 11-game losing streak, but it's right back to the old thing for the Edmonton Oilers.
It's just a disaster. And it's one of those things where, you know, like a car crash, you stare at it and wonder, you know, how could this happen? Like it's fascinating to see because by all accounts, there are pieces on that team, but they just can't put it together. And it makes you wonder, you know, at what point the culture becomes a real factor there. You know, Eakins is a guy that was brought in from another organization. There wasn't any real continuity there. So he was coming into a situation where nobody knew him, but they knew how to lose and they've continued to lose. And so they're going to be left with no choice but to blow it up. But what happens if you blow it up and it turns out that the culture was a problem and all of a sudden Ryan Nugent-Hopkins is kicking butt in Anaheim or wherever?
Right. Well, that's the thing. I mean, if at some point they do start taking the next step or they do start shoring up that defense or they get a core of forwards that's a little more puck possession oriented, are you ever going to break out of this cycle with this group? Because it's a long time now that Taylor Hall has been involved in, you know, I hate the term culture, but this is a losing culture. I mean, and losing culture doesn't even begin to really tell the story in Edmonton. It's a horrific culture and it's just kind of ingrained in the psyche of the Edmonton Oilers the last couple of years.
Yeah, you have to use those words because they've cycled through head coaches and they've cycled through. They made so many roster changes and goalie changes. And it's the same story every season. They haven't shown really any improvement over And they kept getting number one pick after number one pick, and everyone kept expecting to see progress, but it just hasn't been there. At some point, you have to wonder, maybe the top guys aren't as good as we all thought they were.
Yeah.
And this Hall, Nugent Hopkins, Eberle, Yakupov, this group doesn't seem to be meshing. And maybe they didn't, those weren't the right players to build this team. And just throughout the organization, they just keep bringing in these old Oilers. And it seems like this country club atmosphere where Craig McTavish keeps coming back. And he'll probably be the head coach soon, knowing the way they operate. And they might need to blow this whole thing up, because whatever they're doing now is not working. And there's no progress. Outside of landing Connor McDavid in the draft, there's almost no hope.
Well, it seems like he would be the at least a step in the right direction to turning this thing around. And there's no point in trying to win games anymore, really.
Yeah, it's funny because you see guys like Hall, and you wonder, as Jeff said, if, you know, is it really their fault? Were they just totally overhyped? Are they just not that good? But you watch Taylor Hall. I'm just going to use him as an example. You watch him. I've seen him make tremendous plays. I've seen him do things that very few players can do. I know he's not a bad hockey player. I know there's a ton of skill there. But then you also see the video of him, you know, turning the puck over, and he skates really hard, and it looks like he's skating to backcheck, but he's not. He's skating to get off the ice before the goal goes in. And yeah. That's why we use the word culture, because those are the kind of things when you've been criticized so much for your defense and your team's been criticized so much for your plus minus and stuff, that wears on you till you get to the point where, oh, you know, crap, I made an error. I better make sure I can get off the ice before it comes back to bite me. And, you know, if he's in a different situation where he can just showcase his skills, and, you know, if you're in Chicago and your team's, you know, 20 games above 500, you're not worried about skating off for a minus, and you can focus on just playing hockey. And that's when I wonder why letting those players go, because you think they might not be the right players. And then you look back at it and you're like, no, it wasn't the right team.
Yeah, the Oilers maybe should have thought of, you know, the design of that arena as well, where the players come off the ice right in front of the fans, who can get right into their faces.
It was a nice thought at the time.
Yeah, and it'd be nice if they were winning. I'm sure they could, you know, give high fives all down that line, but tough when you've lost 14 of 15. When we come back, going to switch gears, talk a little baseball. Winter meetings wrapping up in San Diego, and it was kind of exciting the way it wrapped up, because there were a ton of moves on Wednesday. Blue Jays didn't do much there. Their work, I guess, for the most part, has been done. It was done before that. We'll evaluate Alex Anthopoulos, his offseason, with a lot more to go. What is going on with the Dodgers? What's going on with the Red Sox? And the Yankees still have lots of work to do as well. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis, alongside Jeff Simmons and Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is the Sportsnet Radio Network.
This ain't like when you're at a game and sign up for a credit card just to get the prize and then you immediately cancel the credit card. Because there's no prize when you sign up for our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. If it's a sports story you're talking about, you can guarantee they'll be talking about it. Unless it's something like arena football. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590. The Fan.
When we were young, oh, we did enough. When it got cold, ooh, we bundled up.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis, alongside Jeff Simmons, Jordan Heath Rawlings. Winter meetings are done. They were in sunny San Diego. It looked like it was a whole bunch of fun. I'm sure Barry Davis, Shai Davidi, Ben Nicholson-Smith, Mike Wilner all had a good time out there. And there was a lot going on. A lot of it late in the day, too, on the West Coast, which meant, like, broke at 2 in the morning East Coast time. Some late media conferences. Dodgers wheeling and dealing, sending Matt Kemp down the coast to San Diego, where he's going to look to, I don't know, do something offensively for a Padres club that has no offense. Red Sox swinging a couple of deals as well, picking up Rick Porcello for Yoenis Cespedes and a couple of minor league pieces from the Detroit Tigers. Also picked up a guy they're pretty familiar with, Justin Masterson. Blue Jays were very silent. The big name pieces are starting to go now. John Lester landing in Chicago with the Cubs. Andrew Miller is gone. He's off the board. He's in New York with the Yankees. David Robertson also gone. Huge term, huge money in Chicago with the White Sox, who have been pretty big movers and shakers as well. And here are the Blue Jays still looking to remake that bullpen. The questions, guys, for this Blue Jays team going into this offseason remain. well, maybe one of them is filled, and we'll see how well in left field. Michael Saunders is going to be given the opportunity to play every day in left field, and we'll see how that works out. But you still have a question at second base, and you still have a question mark in the bullpen. Actually, a bunch of question marks. Where does Aaron Sanchez fit in? There's talk that maybe the Blue Jays go out and get a starter and then allowing Sanchez to go back to the bullpen where he was so good last year. And DH is also a question mark, Justin Smoke. So that being said, I mean, Blue Jays make all these headlines grabbing a guy who is pretty dang good in Josh Donaldson, but there's a lot of question marks for this team, Jordan.
Yeah, there certainly are. I'm not disappointed at all with what the Blue Jays did at the winter meetings. There was a lot of money being thrown around at those meetings and a lot of money being thrown around in places that traditionally you can't rely on getting a return on your investment.
Sure.
The best example I've got for you is that bullpen money. The Jays need help in their bullpen. I don't think anybody would dispute that. But you look around at the deals being handed out, and they're somewhat insane. And the best example I can offer you is if you look at the Blue Jays bullpen from 2 years ago, when they had one of the best bullpens in baseball. They had two all-stars out of that bullpen, and it was cited as one of the team's real strengths. And if those guys had have all been free agents after that year, they would have gotten some of those deals. And every one of them that signed those deals, those teams would have regretted it, because relief pitchers go up and down. A great relief pitcher throws 80 innings, you know, in a year, and it's not that hard in baseball to have your stuff working for you and get on a real roll and put together 40 innings of amazing baseball, and that can get you a huge contract. To me, if you want to rebuild a bullpen the way the Jays do, you have a couple of prospects and you go out and sign volume and you invite a lot of guys to spring training and you look around and you see who's throwing the ball well and you hope you can get a season out of them.
Yeah, it seems like that's the way, I guess, the Blue Jays are going to go about it. There's not many big name relieving free agents out there. There's guys who have closed in the past. I mean, Rafael Soriano's still out there, K-Rod, I guess. But according to Shai Davidi in his conversations with Alex Anthopoulos, it looks like a trade is the best route for the Blue Jays to go out and grab a reliever, which I guess means Deonna Navarro is on the move. We all expect that to happen at some point before opening day of next season. But Jeff, there was a lot being made about the fact that the Blue Jays filled two holes that really didn't need filling, right? Russell Martin, they had a catcher, was pretty good last year. And third base, Josh Donaldson, they had a pretty good catcher, or a pretty good third baseman when he was healthy. That's not that often. In Brett Laurie, it's kind of odd that we're talking about this Blue Jays team remaking itself and still they haven't addressed their biggest problems.
Yeah, that's exactly the thing. They upgraded two spots. Definitely an upgrade defensively behind the plate. And Donaldson, he's been healthy and he's been very durable and he's got more service time. So that's a great upgrade there. But as you mentioned, we still have these holes because those were their big moves. And John Gibbons came out and said there might not be an upgrade at second base. And I thought that was a bit concerning because I think second base was a black hole for them offensively. And Isturiz was out a lot of last year. So I think they need to do something there. And relievers, a lot of the names that they were reportedly interested, they got big money. Luke Regerson was one of the guys they were reportedly very high on. Houston paid him a ton of money. Houston gave it more money, like a ton of money to relievers that they'll probably just kind of flip later to mess around with people. The Yankee, Robertson got a ton of money, 4 years, $40
million. And yeah.
Even some of the starters I thought Brandon McCarthy was a guy that would have filled in. He's a pretty good guy. He got 4 years, a pretty big term for what he's been health-wise, and $12 million a year. So the Jays were almost priced out of almost everything they wanted. And every time Alex talked this week, it seemed. But with the Jays, there's still concerns. And as you mentioned, they're very thin depth-wise. And I was talking to Ben Nicholson-Smith the other day. We were going back and forth. And he sent me what their projected bench is. And I think that was an issue we wrote about last year, how thin they were and one injury can kind of set them back a lot. And they're still pretty thin. You mentioned Smoke as the DH. We don't know what he is. And from 6 to 9, there's a lot of questions there. And in the bullpen. So I think they really need to back up the back end of this roster. And whether that comes through trades or low-end signings that you try to take flyers on, they really need to get better there.
Here's a couple of things that I'll say. There's not a ton of teams in Major League Baseball who are really solid 6 through 9. That
right.
doesn't tend to be, you know, where you find a lot of talent. But also, when you look at this Blue Jays team and you look at the questions that Jeff definitely pointed out, there's questions at second base. There's certainly questions in center field. Is Pompey really ready to start? And yeah, there's questions in left with Michael Saunders, who I think will hit a lot better in Rogers Center, but at the same time has had issues staying healthy and hasn't really been able to be an everyday player. But if you look at the teams that go from being mediocre to becoming a playoff team and making some noise, they tend to be teams who have some really good big pieces that you can rely on, and then teams that find pieces, find unexpected contributions from guys who take that next step. Because you can't realistically, unless you're just willing to spend $350 million, you can't realistically put together a lineup of guys that you'll look at in January and be like, oh, this lineup is set. This lineup's going to be great. So if one of Travis or Pompey can rise to the occasion and become a good above replacement level player, if Saunders can bring a little bit to the table and take the next step and maybe stay healthy, like, those are the pieces that can put you over the top. You can't rely on going out and plugging every hole so that it's plugged. You have to bring in some guys that you hope have upside and count on one or two of them
Blue
to hit.
So Blue Jays fans just need to hope. They need more hope. Is that what you're saying, Jordan?
I think you always need hope in baseball unless you're spending $350 million, and even then that's not a sure thing. Right. It's tough to get in the playoffs in baseball.
Well, also, you look around the American League East, and yes, the Red Sox made a bunch of moves, and they've made some additions, and they've done some signing of players offensively. Pablo Sandoval, Hanley Ramirez, who's going to attempt to play left field next season. That'll be entertaining. That rotation still isn't scaring anybody. You know, Wade Miley was horrible in a great division to be a starting pitcher. Now he goes to the American League East. Now he goes to Fenway Park. That could be interesting. Rick Porcello is a pretty good addition, I think we all agree. Justin Masterson just coming out now that the Red Sox do see him as a starter, so he will start the season at least in their rotation. He was horrible last year. Clay Buchholz, the guy that's probably going to start opening day, was brutal last season. The Yankees still have a lot of question marks in their rotation as well. The bullpen looks pretty good, though, with Betances and now Miller. And the Rays, offense was horrible. Maybe they bounce back there, but and the starters are still good. And the Orioles lost just about everybody that was key to their offensive production a year ago. So if you take the Blue Jays and you look at them from the perspective of what they've done compared to the other teams in the American League East, is it not fair to say that they're still right up there among consideration to win the American League East at this point?
Yeah, they definitely should be considered to be in the mix. You all those teams, there's no team that stands out. I have not been sold on what the Red Sox have done at all. I thought the Hanley Ramirez contract was absolutely nuts. And the pitching, they lose John Lester, who was such a big part of their World Series run. And I don't know if they're trying to replace him in the aggregate, the Moneyball thing, but I don't think what they're doing is, I don't think they have a rotation that can hold up in the AL East. And the Rays have lost a lot of talent. They lost their manager. They lost their general manager. Baltimore lost Cruz and Markakis and Andrew Miller. So getting Donaldson and Russell Martin really bumps up the Jays, who were just a couple games out of the playoffs last year with a horrific bullpen and a starting rotation that didn't get much out of Stroman until the second half of the year. And Norris might be in it this year, and Sanchez could even start. So there is still a lot of hope, as we mentioned, but you still would like to see them shore up their weaknesses. That just because the division's weak doesn't mean we shouldn't want them to do that.
Yeah,
right?
They should have the opportunity to shore up their weakness. They should bring in some guys and see if they're better than the guys they have there. It's funny about the Red Sox. That rotation is really interesting to me because I was talking a little bit ago about upside, and those are a bunch of pitchers who are ground ball pitchers, a couple of whom are coming off really bad years, like you mentioned, but also a couple of guys who have pitched well in the past. And you look at that rotation, and you can easily see how it could be a total dumpster fire. You can also see that if they get, you know, a couple of upgrades around, like a couple of guys overachieving, it could be a rotation that could be okay in relation to their lineup, which should be pretty good if Hanley Ramirez can stay healthy. I think the division's there for the Jays. I think you have four teams in the AL East who could all win the division, and I think you're going to see, you know, they're all going to be between 80 and 93 wins.
Yeah, it's and still there's a lot to play out. Max Scherzer is still out there. James Shields is still out there as well. I think the Yankees probably going to throw a couple of ducats at one of those starting pitchers, you would imagine, before it's all said and done. Speaking of a team splashing some money and not used to seeing that, at least the last couple of years. Chicago Cubs getting it done with Theo Epstein. They've improved year after year the last 3 or 4 years in win totals, again into the 70s this year. And now they go out, and you mentioned Joe Maddon on the move. He's the new field manager at Wrigley. They have all these young offensive weapons who are starting to figure it out, get closer to the major leagues. I mean, Chris Bryant, everybody salivating at the possibility of that bat playing in the major leagues. And now you got John Lester now to anchor that rotation. Should we be talking about the Cubs in all our conversations about World Series possibilities? I mean, could we be talking about the Cubs here when we're at this point, you know, 12 months from now?
Maybe in 2016, but
yeah.
I don't think World Series yet, but I think they could be a potential playoff team, or at least a fringe playoff team. And I think John Lester going to the NL, he could be even better than he's been. He's been really good. Everyone knows how much pitchers' numbers are inflated by that league. And it was strange seeing Joe Maddon actually sign a premier free agent coming from Tampa.
Yeah, that's going to be weird for him, right?
I know, coming from Tampa where they've just had to get by and they've just taken bargains on everyone. But they got a ton of prospects, and Chris Bryan and Soler, and they have a couple shortstops, and they got a really deep – Theo Epstein's really done a nice job building that team. And
Does he go into the Hall of Fame, like, immediately if he wins a World Series with the Cubs, breaking that century-long drought after breaking the drought with the Red Sox? I mean, is there an executive out there that deserves to be in the Hall of Fame more than Theo Epstein if he gets that done?
I think he already – I mean, just for the Red Sox, he's probably already got a decent case. And if he can go out there with the Cubs, sure. I'm looking forward to watching the Cubs because they're an interesting team that plays in a great ballpark, has a manager with a lot of personality, and there's some really good young bats. I totally agree with Jeff. I think it's a little early to start talking about the Cubs as a World Series team, though it's always fun to imagine the Cubs as a World Series team just because, man, late October baseball in Wrigley Field with these guys losing their minds and bringing goat jinx signs to the game and ghosts of Steve Bartman, and oh man, the narrative would be unbelievable.
The Dodgers, also one of those teams wheeling and dealing at the winter meetings. They've remade things, sending Matt Kemp. That was the big move to the Padres. Also picking up an all-star second baseman in Howie Kendrick. The offense will involve Jock Peterson now. They had just too many outfielders a season ago. And Jimmy Rollins, the old man, 36-year-old, going to play shortstop for them. Andrew Friedman, talking about the Rays. Must be, I mean, it's weird for Joe Maddon to have some money in Chicago. It's got to be just as weird for Andrew Friedman to basically be working with Monopoly money when it comes to the Dodgers.
And you saw what he did. You saw what he did at the winter meetings. That was crazy. He rebuilt the middle infield, the entire middle infield. He cleared room for Jock Peterson. He was flipping guy, Trey D. Gordon for Heaney, flips him right away. So I thought Friedman was one of the best personnel guys in baseball the last few years. Just the amount of moves he made that worked, and they're all these low-budget moves, and they seem to have this magic there that eventually ran out last year. But when he has money, that's a scary situation, and they cleared out even some more money by getting rid of Kemp, but they're still paying some of that contract.
Yeah, $30 million headed to the Padres as well.
But you give that guy money, that's a scary situation.
That's a fun-looking team, eh?
Yeah.
It's just going to be a good time to watch the Dodgers next year. They've got Clayton Kershaw is always worth your time to sit down and watch, and so many young athletes on
at least
team.
In the regular season.
Oh, come on.
That was unbelievable what happened to him in the postseason. But a regular season for the ages for Clayton Kershaw.
I'm excited. Anyway, I'm excited to see that. I would pick a lot of people, I'm sure, will be picking the Dodgers. But I think they're going to be better without Matt Kemp. And they look so good. They look like such a fun team.
It's fun to go to that ballpark as well, especially when you're sitting in the all-you-can-eat Dodger dog seats, which I've done. It's entertaining. Trust me.
How many did you eat?
Yeah, only like 3 or 4.
Oh.
Which was kind of, they're large dogs, though. Week 15 in the National Football League has begun. The Cardinals beating the Rams without the benefit of scoring a touchdown. 12-6 on Thursday. They've pretty much clinched a playoff spot in the NFC at 11-3. I think they need the Cowboys and the Eagles not to tie. If they don't tie tomorrow, the Cardinals are officially in. We'll talk a little NFL coming up next. We'll talk about the Cardinals and the possibility of a wild card team being sub 500, going on the road, and still maybe being a favorite in that game, and all the possible permutations of playoff matchups. We'll also break down, I mentioned that big matchup, NFC East style, and what's gone on with the 49ers, and I guess Jordan will get to gloat a little bit because he saw this thing coming just a little bit. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live with Jordan Heath Rawlings and Jeff Simmons. I'm Ben Ennis on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
The CHL Podcast with Jeff Merrick and Sam Cosentino.
You're trying to feed the guns, you know. I'm not sure if they're soft guns or Uzis.
I'm trying to figure out, in my mind, I know they're different types of skaters, but is he just flat out a faster skater than Nathan MacKinnon was in Halifax?
I guess we didn't play very well, or at least I didn't. And the season seat holder didn't recognize me and said something like, well, that wasn't a bad game last night, but boy, did Rudy ever stink.
He's a wonderful, wonderful player that never really gets the credit.
Here's our podcast pledge to you, gentle listeners. Sam and I will be sober on that day. How about that? That's our pledge to you.
Yeah, I'm glad you made it.
From now until the MasterCard Memorial Cup, this is the destination for news, opinion, and prospects. Find this and more on Sportsnet.ca. Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Mom and Dad went to a show. Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Jordan Heath Rawlings and Jeff Simmons. Week 15. The NFL season, which is kind of sad. Kind of makes me sad to say that. Week 15. Zoning in on the end of the NFL season. But this is crunch time. It's exciting. Every game means something. And, of course, it being late in the season, we've got a whole bunch of divisional matchups. Had one on Thursday with the Cardinals beating the Rams. A couple of great defenses going at it. So if you like defensive football, maybe you like that. Maybe not strong quarterback play. And it's going to be a tough go for the Cards going forward, especially if they're without Drew Stanton for the rest of the season. Maybe go out and grab one of those free agents, those sexy free agent QBs late in the NFL season, like Rex Grossman or something. We'll have to see. But they are 11-3, and looks like they're headed to the playoffs. Let's have a look at some of the games going on this weekend, guys. I think for most people, the game of the week is there's a couple of different reasons. Bengals-Browns is the game of the week for a lot of people. It's a divisional matchup. It's the Browns now desperate for a win at 7-6. And, of course, there's this little thing I like to call Johnny Football. Johnny Manziel making his first start in the National Football League. Brian Hoyer got him to this point. They were right in the playoff mix. And I guess they're still in the mix, but now they're kind of on life support. It's tough when you're 7-6 and dead last in your division, but that's the situation for the Cleveland Browns. That would be a tremendous story. If Johnny Football comes in, runs the table last three games, and gets the Brownies into the playoffs for the first time in forever. I just don't know how likely it is, Jordan.
It's possible. Anything's possible in the narrative of Johnny Football, but to say that Brian Hoyer got them to this point is a little... Brian Hoyer was the quarterback of a great defense that got them to this point against overwhelming mediocrity from the quarterback position. They should have gone, if they really had designs on a special season and making waves and doing some damage, they should have at least made steps to see what Johnny Football could do.
How do you make
that
move before they did, though? I mean, you got to, I know the numbers were bad, but wins are wins, right?
I don't know. I mean, we were talking earlier about how goalies get don't get enough credit for stealing games for their teams. And if you're looking at your quarterback play and you're winning despite the fact that your quarterback's throwing more interceptions than touchdowns and missing his receivers by 3 feet, why wouldn't you make a change to get better? The Cleveland Browns have a terrible problem with playmakers, and it's not finding playmakers because they have them. It's actually getting the ball to their playmakers. They kept Johnny Football on the bench. It took them 8 weeks to realize that Crowell was their best running back. Jordan Cameron is a great playmaker. He's battled injury issues, and of course Josh Gordon can't stay on the field because of disciplinary issues. That's an offense with, you know, a good player at every position. Well, we don't know about Manziel, but a good player at all of the other skill positions, and they can't seem to make it work.
Yeah, defensive head coaches are kind of conservative by nature, and you're seeing that for Mike Pettine. And they went with Hoyer a bit too long. I'm kind of with Ben that it would have been a hard transition until I think last week.
Yeah. I think at halftime, maybe you may have to make a move in that game.
See, yeah, that was the defense played incredible. They had
They had the lead at halftime, but late in that game, it was clear Brian Hoyer wasn't going to do anything.
He single-handedly cost them that game. Yeah. I hate to put too much on the quarterback, but the defense was great, and they're all over Andrew Luck, who's been a legit MVP candidate this year. And to not put Manziel in that game was pretty worrisome from that perspective. As Jordan was saying, their offense is just very strange, and they kept splitting backs between three people before letting go of Ben Tate, and Miles Austin was one of their featured receivers, and he's way over the hill. And you got to see what you have with this guy. And Manziel, even that from that one drive you saw in Buffalo, he gave a complete boost and a complete spark to that team. And you would have liked to see that last week when they were getting absolutely nothing from the offense in a game they really should have won.
Yeah, you're going to see Manziel make mistakes. I have no doubt that he's gonna try to force a ball into coverage, and he's going to get picked a couple times. But guess what? Brian Hoyer was forcing balls into coverage and getting picked, and he can't run, and he can't find guys deep. So at least you get the upside with the downside as opposed to just the downside.
The AFC North is pretty damn good. Everybody's over 500, and imagine the Browns are dead last at 7-6.
The AFC North is not that good. The AFC North is a team of competitive defenses who also happen to play the NFC South in their interdivisional game.
Well,
that helps a lot.
Well, how do we break it down then? Because you look at the Bengals leading that division at 8-4-1, and Andy Dalton, we're used to seeing the swoon come in the playoffs. He's had his moments during the regular season. He also had one of the worst performances ever by a quarterback in that Thursday night game against the Browns, and no doubt he'll be looking for a little revenge this week. How do you forecast this division playing out here the final 3 weeks of the season with Cincy a little half game edge on Pittsburgh and Baltimore, so obviously controlling their destinies. But Pittsburgh, we know that offense is explosive, but defensively some real liabilities. Anytime you can lose to the New York Jets, that's problematic. Baltimore, they've been there before. And then Cleveland, I guess, with the wild card, the great defense, and who knows what you're going to get out of Johnny Football.
I like Baltimore of that group. I think they're the most consistent team on both sides. Pittsburgh's got the explosive offense, but as you said, they lost to the Jets and they lost to the Bucs.
Yeah.
Those are two of the worst
teams.
That's
difficult to do. Not everybody can put that on their resume.
And at the same time, Roethlisberger threw for 500 yards.
It seemed like week after week.
Twice.
He was doing that.
You get your, as we said with the Leafs earlier, you get your extreme highs and lows, but Baltimore's the consistent team there. I think Joe Flacco and the running game's been pretty good, and their offense has been better than usual. Gary Kubiak's made a big difference there, and they got a pretty good pass rush. It showed up big in Miami last week. And unless Johnny Football really is the real deal, I'm still worrisome about Dalton to go with the Bengals. They were lucky to beat Tampa in a game that they got a fluke 12 man in the field penalty. And they've just been so wonky all year. I find it hard to believe in them.
So, yeah, I'm going to go with Pittsburgh here because Baltimore, great defense, well coached team, has zero secondary whatsoever. Their best players in the secondary have been gone for a long time. And if you look at that division and where they're likely to end up, they're probably going to be playing San Diego maybe as a wild card team. Maybe Pittsburgh, who finishes second, as a wild card team. If they play a good quarterback can carve up that secondary. And so, I don't know. You talk about Baltimore having been there before. Pittsburgh's been there before a couple of times, too. And yeah. I'm going to go with the best talent, which is Roethlisberger, who's the best quarterback in that division. Antonio Brown's the best wide receiver in that division. And Le'Veon Bell's the best running back in that division. So, boom.
It's good thing Baltimore plays Jacksonville this week, and they can't pass.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, that helps. All right, if the AFC North isn't the best division then, Jordan, maybe the NFC West is. That's the division we've been talking about. And, yes, St. Louis is 6-8 and below 500. But maybe if they had half decent, well, okay, maybe not half decent, but if they had better quarterback play, they could be right in the thick of things. They have a great defense and showcased it against the Cardinals on Thursday. They're 6-8. Arizona in control of the division with a two-game lead on Seattle at 11-3. The Seahawks 9-4, and it looks like the Niners going to be on the outside looking in unless some sort of miracle happens here down the stretch. They are 7-6. You got the divisional matchup of the Niners and Seahawks this week. It's a situation where I guess if the season was maybe three games longer, you could probably see the Seahawks passing the Cardinals, or is there still enough time? I mean, a loss this week would change things significantly. But if they win this week, I guess the possibility still very much exists that they could pass Arizona for that that division title.
Yeah, well, especially depending on what happens with Arizona's quarterback situation. I mean, they're now down to the backup and whether they'll sign a free agent or maybe go with Logan Thomas, I'm not sure. But it's funny, you look at that division, and I know the 49ers are 6-7, and kind of the 49ers are the worst team in that division, and I don't think it's that close. The Rams,
they're getting almost 10 points this week against Seattle.
Well, you go into Seattle against Seattle the way the defense is playing right now, and a lot of teams would be getting 10 points against the Seahawks right now. But that Rams team is frisky, and if they had, Jeff Fisher said before the game on Thursday night that if they had 8 more games, he'd like their chances of getting in the playoffs, and so would I. And Sean Hill has been mediocre, probably been better than Brian Hoyer, but he's been mediocre. But Sean Hill's probably still been better than Colin Kaepernick the last few weeks.
Yeah, what's going on with the 49ers? And you kind of called this when we talked before the season, Jordan, but I think you were more saying that the defense would regress a little bit, and I guess maybe it has, but that hasn't been the problem. It's been putting points on the board. They can't do it. Colin Kaepernick looks horrible.
Yeah, well, I went down there, right? I went down there to do a story for the NFL preview, and just kind of, it wasn't necessarily just the defense. It's just what I ended up seeing was that there was a ton of little things that were wrong. They weren't, you know, even in their preseason game, and some of the players talked about it in practices, that just like, you know, they weren't in sync. There wasn't the kind of, you know, click, click, click that a real contender. The 49ers had been to 2 NFC championship games and 1 Super Bowl the last 3 years. So, you know, basically the NFC championship was kind of the expectation to start this year. And it's just it's one of those things that shows you how quickly your window can close in the NFL. If you're not
on
top
of it. Closed?
Well, I think the window is pretty much closed on the Harbaugh era.
And here's the thing about Harbaugh. All that stuff came out about him and the team before the season. And the more you talk to people around the league, the sense is that the way he coaches and his personality, there's kind of an expiry date on him. And as good as he's done, he completely turned around that franchise. And they were a disaster with Mike Singletary. It's kind of amazing. When you talk to some people, they said the same thing happened at Stanford. And Stanford was a horrific football team before he got there. And when he left, after all he did for them, they were thrilled. That's just his, and it seems that's kind of the case that's happened in San Francisco. And the GM, you saw the owner tweet after the Seattle game that they were embarrassed by the performance. I've almost never seen that before.
Yeah.
I think that, and it's the people who cover that team locally just know, they're talking about this as a matter of fact, that the players have almost given up on him. But the quarterback thing is a whole different story. That's unexplainable what's happened to Kaepernick.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you can say the underlying coach thing maybe affects the team as a whole, but does it affect Colin Kaepernick directly? I mean, is that what you can attribute his poor season to? Is Harbaugh?
No, I think the league's kind of figured him out. And the thing with Kaepernick, and I've watched him very closely, is you can really slow him down with a good game plan. He hasn't ran as much this year, which has been kind of strange, because considering that's his best asset. There's a couple of things that you watch and you see as red flags. One, he can't throw a pass other than a fastball.
Yeah.
So he struggles throwing people open, and he struggles seeing the field on a second read. If a guy's an open on his first read, Kaepernick never makes a play unless he's extending with his legs. So he can't do those touch passes that make some of the other running quarterbacks better than him. And he's really struggled with that. And when a defense like Seattle, what we saw with them a few weeks ago, when they shut down his receiving game, he has nothing and he just throws the ball away.
It's funny when you look at the way Kaepernick throws passes, because you're talking about the fastballs. A lot of quarterbacks come into the league throwing heat, and that's just kind of, it's what you do in college. You want to show off your arm. You got a big gun. You want to get it downfield. The ones that stick around and become great quarterbacks are the ones that learn when to go with the fastball and when to go. Like Brett Favre is a perfect example, right? Brett Favre could throw a ball that would break receivers' fingers. And he came to the league doing that, and he had some success doing that. But when he turned into a complete quarterback that won Super Bowls was when he learned to float those little passes, those little kind of, they maybe even look like they wobble in the air a little bit, but you drop them past the defensive backs. You drop your receivers open. Peyton Manning has no fastball anymore. He does it all with those little touch passes. And they're so effective because you can pick your spots, and you don't have to rely on your guys getting a full step and the pass coming in hot. And it's also, it's just easier for guys to catch.
Yeah, he gives hope to every kid out there who can't throw a spiral. Perfect spiral, right? Like, how many perfect spirals does Peyton Manning throw?
He doesn't have to throw a perfect spiral because it just has to land in the right spot. Guys know how to catch footballs.
Yeah, no question. Stick with the NFC here and go to the NFC North, which has a couple of pretty good teams, obviously, in Green Bay and Detroit. But it's the bottom of that division that is kind of fun to talk about, especially recently, the Chicago Bears and Mark Trestman. We know the great success he's had in the CFL. The story coming out that they have a little buyer's remorse on Jay Cutler. Not that they had too many choices there. They almost have to resign him. But they did, and it's not going so well. And now apparently offensive coordinator who leaked that story broke down in tears in front of his team. What's gone on with the Bears? Because they have offensive pieces, right? Should they be as bad as 5-8 here in week 15?
I mean, I think their record is indicative of how they've played. You know, I watch a lot of the NFC North, and the Bears are one of the most emotionally fragile football teams that I've seen in a long time. And it's one of those things where, like, as we talked about with the Oilers a little bit earlier, you don't like to put too much on the culture. And this is not a culture of winning or losing. It's a culture of emotions. And it starts with Jay Cutler, who's always been sort of up and down quarterback. Brandon Marshall, who wears his heart on his sleeve and isn't shy about saying whatever he thinks. And you know, sometimes that's great and it gets your team fired up. But when things start going badly, it leads to a lot of sniping. And Cutler and Marshall are really good friends and they're very close. But when things are going this badly, you hear even them sniping at each other. And I think the toughest part is that Cutler contract, because they were in, like you said, they had to re-sign him because there's such a dearth of quality, you know, guys who can win you a game out there on the free agent market, that if you let one of those guys go, all of a sudden you're looking at Sean Hill and Drew Stanton and guys, Mark Sanchez, and guys who are kind of totally unproven, or at the very least known quantities. Jay Cutler can throw for 4 touchdowns and 300 yards in a game, and there's probably only 15 QBs in the NFL that can do that. But so you have to pay him, but you have to pay him so much that all of a sudden your salary cap is looking messed up, and you've also got a quarterback who can lose you a game.
Yeah, and the Bengals went through the same thing with Dalton, and the Chiefs did the same thing with Alex Smith.
The Ravens and Joe Flacco?
Yeah, it's almost purgatory.
Yeah.
Because there's no right decision.
Well, Seattle's going to have to go through it with Russell Wilson coming up, right?
Yeah, but I think there's a different case. I think their salary cap is structured very well. The cap's going up, and they've locked up a lot of their big guys already. I think Wilson's a guy who's going to get better. He's doing a pretty decent job with almost no receivers right now. And he makes all these plays on improvisation, but I don't think he's the kind of guy who's going to hold back the franchise, even though he's going to be probably paid more than he's worth.
He's going to be a guy who can win you a game, though, which is important, right? That's what we were talking about with Jay Cutler. Russell Wilson is not the same kind of quarterback as Jay Cutler, but he's got the ability to do all the things you need to do to win a game. He can throw a deep ball. He can make plays with his legs. He can hit receivers with short passes, and they've given him almost nothing to work with, and he's finding ways to win games. It's not pretty for him right now because he doesn't have the talent around him that he's open for, but he's getting it done, and that's the mark of a guy that maybe you do want to pay.
Yeah, and you talk about only being able to throw the fastball for Colin Kaepernick. I mean, how many of those plays does Russell Wilson make where he draws the defenders with the legs and then able to lob it over them for the first down? Let's check out the AFC for a little bit. And the New England Patriots, I think we all understand, are the class of it because, you know, they've beaten the Broncos. They own the tiebreaker there, control their own destiny as far as the number one seed is concerned. The Miami Dolphins are kind of an interesting case. They already beat them, right? They beat them opening game of the season. They're 7-6, kind of on life support when it comes to the playoffs. There's a bunch of teams kind of jammed in there in the AFC. San Diego holds down the second wild card at 8-5. Baltimore's also 8-5, but you got Houston, Miami, Kansas City, Buffalo, and Cleveland all at 7-6. And all of those teams at one point this season looked like they were pretty pretty good to make the playoffs in the AFC. But the Dolphins, I guess you can say this about the Bills as well, those defenses at times can be scary, and the Patriots still have them a couple more times in the final three games of the season.
They do. The Bills are in a tight spot because they have the Packers this week and they have the Patriots still to come. And they're in a position where they pretty much have to win out in order to make the playoffs. So if you're looking, Buffalo's surprised this year. They're a good team. They have problems at quarterback, like probably about 30% of the league.
Sure.
But Sammy Watkins and Robert Woods seem to certainly be a good pair to build an offense around. There's some talent at running back.
Problem with Buffalo is they don't have a first-round pick next year.
Yeah, right. That's a big deal.
So they can't fix their quarterback right away. But But Miami's a strange team. They're almost capable of anything. We saw them beat New England. They should have beat Green Bay. They screwed that one up. But they're also capable of losing. Like they played like garbage against the Jets on Monday night. And I wonder how much it's a coaching issue. This week we heard stories that one of the defensive linemen was screaming at the coach to get away from him after the game. And I think they need some fresh blood in there because they have the talent. They got a pretty good young quarterback and they got a really good defense and some emerging receiving weapons. And they're still that same old 500. They're almost like the Blue Jays in a sense that they always provide you this little bit of hope and end up right around 500. And
that's the same coach that presided over that locker room. That was, I think anybody would agree that it's toxic.
Yeah, there's a clear lack of leadership there.
Yeah, there's no structure.
The Denver Broncos are kind of doing things a little differently offensively these days, going back and committing themselves to the running game a little bit more. And you mentioned the Bills looking pretty good in that game last week. Could have won that game. It was just a 7-point game. Denver taking it 24-17, but the Bills putting a hurt on them defensively, getting to the quarterback. And yes, the Broncos can get it done to a certain degree with the running game now, but Peyton Manning hasn't exactly looked like the Peyton Manning of old the last couple of weeks as well. Are there question marks in Denver, or would you still say that they are right there with the Patriots as far as the favorites in the AFC?
You go ahead.
There's question marks when we get to January.
Yeah.
Because Peyton Manning's history, and his history in cold weather, but I don't think you can discount Peyton Manning. So it's a little stretch, but they've found a way to win, and I think they're definitely right there with New England. And
this running game has been great for them. Yeah. It's fantastic for the Broncos to find another way to put up points. And I don't think Buffalo was even that close. They scored a late touchdown in that game to make it look a little closer than it was. But I watched most of that game. It was never in doubt. And I think losing Julius Thomas for the last few weeks has actually hurt Peyton a little bit. It's not so much that the Broncos can't move the ball without him, but he's one of the best red zone weapons in the league, and he opens things up for Demaryius Thomas, who's very similar in that they both like to catch short passes and either, convert in the red zone or, in Thomas's case, make long gains by beating tacklers. I think that the Broncos are a really well-structured offense now if they can stick with C.J. Anderson. It creates a lot of holes for guys like Thomas. We got to keep calling them by their first names,
right? But
a lot of holes for guys like Julius Thomas and especially Emmanuel Sanders to get open over the middle because the defense have to draw in to stop CJ.
All right. Before we go, let's break down the Sunday nighter as well. Cowboys and Eagles. Once again, the Eagles dominated that matchup on Thanksgiving, both teams 9-4. It's certainly more pressure is on the Cowboys in this game, having lost that game on Thanksgiving. And they're 9-4, but in a tough NFC, right now they're on the outside of the playoff picture looking in. And Mark Sanchez, whoever you throw in there apparently for the Eagles, they can get it done in Chip Kelly's offense. How do we look at this game?
This is a massive game for Dallas, and this could be their season because if Philly beats them, they lose the NFC's tiebreaker, and the Eagles will sweep them, and they'll make Dallas probably lose the game on Seattle and maybe Detroit, and this could sink them. And Dallas they got Indianapolis the week after, so they got their defense going to have to go up against Andrew Luck. And we've all laughed at them for going 8-8 all these years. They're already at 9 wins, and they still might not make the playoffs. So this is kind of just, they can't catch a break. It's kind of funny.
The Cowboys are in real trouble this week because they've got, their offensive line has carried them through this year, made DeMarco Murray look fantastic. But you saw the last time they played Philadelphia, their defensive line might create running holes. It's questionable in pass protection. The Eagles throw a lot of different looks at you in the blitz. They come from all sorts of stunts. They come back around, and Dallas couldn't handle it before. And they're going to be studying film hard, no doubt, based on the last game. But if they can't keep Tony Romo upright, they have no chance in this game because that Philly defense, they might not have real, real playmakers, but they get after it.
You're right. They played really well last week, too.
Gents, thanks a lot for this. It's been great. It's another edition of Sportsnet Magazine Live coming your way for the next hour. I've got an edition of Sportsnet Today. This has been Sportsnet Magazine Live. Jordan Heath-Rawlings and Jeff Simmons on the Sportsnet Radio Network.